Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, co-founder of AEG Systems, and of course, the proud host of VFE. And today's guest, it's been 3 years in the making. So I want to give you a story of how Daniel and I met. And then it became the evolution of, everybody knows, the Agile Diagnostic and AI platform and AEG systems. So about 3 years ago, no, four years ago, right, Daniel? Or is it three?
Three.
Four?
Three.
Time flies, man. So 3 years ago, this is classic. And I'll tell you, I would say, A, it was, you know, a blessing in disguise that God had us meet. And then two, just a little luck. So just like the New York Knicks in game four. But I was in, we were at EdTech Week, and I saw the line, and at first, I wasn't going to wait. So I said, okay. So I left the site that we were at, and I was just about to hit for Uber, and just about to hit my Uber, and then literally, I saw the lunch place that I wanted to go to was in Midtown, and the Uber ride, no lie, and everybody could laugh, it was about $50, no lie, $50, and I was like, you know what? I am not going to pay $50 just to get down and then to get back probably within 90 minutes or so. So I said, I'll tough it out and I'll wait in line. So I went back upstairs. And as I went back upstairs, the line was going around for lunch, was going around the corner. And I got in line and guess who was in front of me? Mr. Daniel Crook. So everybody knows how I am. And I just said, hey, we got a long line. We might as well talk, get to know each other. And that's where Daniel and I started to talk. And then Daniel started to unpack his expertise and a concept and an idea that I had in my head, floating in my head. I'm like, oh my God, this guy can potentially do it. So I said, hey, Daniel, you know, I really have this crazy idea of developing AI around change management and continuous improvement with my research. Could you do it? And without hesitation, Daniel said yes. Now, because of the success, he was at that early startup point. Because of his natural progression and success that within School Harbor, what we're going to talk about, if I was about 3 years later, the answer would be absolutely no.
Three months. Well, I think you're leaving out the point that any software engineer listening will chuckle about, which is the classic trope of, hey, I've got an idea. You're a software engineer. Let's go in on it. You build it. I'll be the CEO. And that morning before EdTech Week, you know, I had just started my business and I told myself, okay, you know, the business is very early, don't have a lot of opportunities in my pipeline. So I'm going to say yes to everything. And so when, you know, and I had no idea who you were, Doctor, I didn't realize I was talking to the Michael Connor. I mean, you seemed smart right away. I mean, there was an immediate trust, you know, I'd be underselling the conversation if I said I just said yes to a complete stranger. But yeah, that's definitely not how, you know, things are done now, but very grateful that we bumped into each other in that lunch line.
Yeah. And that's why I say I'm blessed and very lucky with that, right? And then 3 years later, Daniel has just been an absolutely amazing partner to me. You know, we have come up with the concept where now we have the Agile Diagnostic and AI platform that's being level set across the country. We have some really new, pretty cool partnerships that are on the horizon for the 26-27 academic year. But that is just a small slither of what Daniel has accomplished within the education ecosystem. He has one of the most successful EdTech companies in School Harbor, where this is how you know you're successful. When you matriculate out of being the CEO to just only a board member. Okay, so I think that right there is a mic drop stuff. And then also he advises EdTech companies and early startups and founders across the country. The guy is busy. I think it's harder to get in touch with Daniel than Barack Obama, but no, it is an absolute honor to have my friend, my co-founder, my partner in crime in this education vertical, Mr. Daniel Crook, who is the founder of School Harbor. and also the co-founder of AEG Systems, and then is involved in a myriad of different edtech focuses across the country. So Daniel, I'm probably understating what your accomplishments are now, what you're doing now, but it is absolutely an honor to have you on Voices for Excellence.
No, and thanks for having me. I know we've been talking about doing this for a while, and I would say that you're more difficult to reach than I am in terms of your schedule. And so between our schedules, it's really great we found this time.
Absolutely. Daniel, great to have you on. And Daniel, I want to jump right into this because, you know, if I've known you for 3 years, we've talked a lot. We've seen each other a lot over the course of 3 years. You, your wonderful wife, Letty, who is probably one of the best UX designers in the country, and then also with your school Harbor team as well. But Daniel, as a successful edtech company founder, co-founder of AEG Systems with that crazy guy, Dr. Michael Connor, and a strategic advisor to many, Daniel, you're such an influencer in a variety of different verticals. But for those that don't know Mr. Daniel Crook, and I'm very interested too in this, what song describes your leadership signature in the ecosystem?
You know what's funny about this? Did you know I was a music major?
Yes, I did.
And a career violinist. So I actually put a lot of thought into this, and this question stumped me. So I'm actually going to have to answer this with John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds.
Oh, wow.
Do you know this piece of music? This is actually like a little music history lesson for those listening. It's a piece by a modern composer named John Cage, where for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, he comes out to the piano, he sits down, he doesn't do anything, and then is silent for 4 minutes and 33 seconds and then walks off the stage. And so this is my not answer, because I could not come up with a piece of music to describe my space. You know, I took the question very seriously, but I figured this would be an interesting moment to give you a creative not answer and also let you know about one of the strangest pieces written in the last 100 years. Very controversial piece of music. That is it music? Is it not? It's, you know, the sound of the audience. It's the coughing. It's the sort of tension and confusion of coming to a music concert and 4 minutes and 33 seconds hearing nothing but your own breath and maybe somebody's cell phone going off. So that's my answer.
So, Daniel, I find that compelling, right? Because when I put now, because I always like to tie this back into education, and John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds. And when I hear that, the sound of the audience, the cell phone, breathing, micro conversations that are going on in there, right? When I think about that context in itself, have we truly, as educational leaders, as advisors, as ed tech CEOs, have we really truly had that silent landscape understanding of who we're serving, right? I mean, there could be a variety of different perspectives that you can take on this, but really just, you know, understanding who's in that landscape, understanding our students, knowing them, just watching them. But also too, if you think about that, you know, from an audience perspective, looking at John Cage to sit there for 4 minutes and 33 seconds, I think about leadership presence, right? Where now you are establishing that presence, where that is the art of music. That is where now that presence, even though it's silence, there's so much, there's music from a variety and a diversity of different facets that are going on simultaneously. Daniel, I knew that you were going to identify something that is much of an outlier, but brings such of a deep meaning when it comes to your leadership signature. And you're right about that, because Daniel, your presence is felt in the vertical within the ecosystem. And Daniel, you do not say much. I can tell you that. But it's impactful though.
I think it's about, it's interesting how I think you've captured a lot of, you know, how that piece is like interpreted, which is, you know, the stage and the audience, even just from like percentage of the total volume of space in a theater, like, you know, I think John Cage is showing everyone that their presence is part of the performance. I mean, think about like a bizarre, like a triangle solo. That was like the audience solo, right? The audience gets to sort of be the sounds. Yeah, so that's my answer. If I come up with something like, you know,
oh wow,
that has a little bit more sound, I'll let you know.
Oh no! I like that, because Daniel, this is probably the quote of this question. Their presence is a part of the performance, and when I think about the ecosystem and the various verticals that are integrated and interface with one another, that makes education in totality. Everybody's presence is a part of the performance, which the performance is obviously impacting the lives of our constituents. But Daniel, School Harbor, right? 3 years ago, wow. I mean, just congratulations on your transition now to just being a part of the board and a founder of School Harbor. Shout out to Jarrett, who has become the new CEO. An amazing, amazing group. And to my audience, this is objective and subjective, that please, anything that you need from a technological standpoint, anything that you need to be able to support your data infrastructure, anything pertaining to that architecture, School Harbor, that full team. The reason why I know that full team is because, of course, they are helping and they continuously help leverage the agile diagnostic and AI platform. But Daniel, right now, School Harbor is truly positioned as an influencer in the educational ecosystem. But through the lens of a successful founder of an edtech company, Daniel, what do you see now as the biggest misalignment between what is being developed in edtech? You and I had these conversations before. I even heard you talk about this at various conferences in our small groups too. But what is the biggest misalignment that you see of what is being developed in edtech and what is actually needed in our learning organizations and classrooms for, again, the people that we support, our most important customers, who are Generation Alpha and Beta?
Yeah, well, and that's a really great question. And I'm going to frame my answer around early companies, because, you know, that's really where my specialty lies. And I think I want to answer this with talk about two things in this question. I think one of the things that where there's a misalignment would be I think that the ratio of student-facing tools and tools for learning, I think that I think that that is a very saturated space. And I think that not enough attention is given to more administrative problems. And I think that there's a lot of opportunity for folks to help schools reduce the burden of their back office to make not just to save keystrokes, but to actually do that while improving business intelligence that helps leaders make faster, more robust decisions. So there's a lot of disjunct tools in the classroom on campuses, and that information isn't aggregating successfully to that administrative unit, be it a district office or a charter school leader, small or large. I think that, and especially in an age of, you know, where AI is this emerging, fast developing technology, it's never been more important to have great, easy to use data for that purpose. And so I think a lot of folks are still, and I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing, but I think there's so much focus on building tools for learners. And I think there could be a lot more focus on building tools for at the operational level. I also think that when it comes to the approach of building, I think in general, a lot of early founders kind of run with their first idea and I think much more attention could be paid at the pre-build ideation. Like before you start prototyping, I'll talk to a lot of folks who are thinking about building in the space and they haven't done enough time talking to leaders. I think it's actually one of the things that's made, you know, our work with the Agile Diagnostic Platform as successful as it's been is that before we started building, you know, Dr. Connor, you've talked to the superintendent user that we serve exhaustively before I started typing a single line of code. And so that is something I think that as people are thinking about building solutions, even if you're a district administrator yourself, building an internal tool for your team, I think maybe this is a pretend stat, this is a heuristic, but maybe one in 50 people in an administrative role have started vibe coding. You know, I'm talking to a lot. There's a every and this is, you know, before AI, there have still been, I think people don't know this, that development, software development tools have been progressively making the barrier to developing software easier and easier. Like we saw this with the cloud, right? The cloud technologies made it easier for developers to develop software in the same way that AI is. And so every time that barrier to entry gets, you know, easier and easier, we have more people who are fundamentally builders entering the space. And so some, you know, I've been spending a lot of time talking to folks who are, you know, our business leaders and experts who are now like, hey, I just spent the last 90 hours on Lovable or Replit and I'm enjoying this building. And so I think, you know, there's a lot of opportunity before you start building, like even if you're building in that way in your district with those tools, to still, as much as an expert as you are, to still have those conversations with the people who you expect to be using your application. I think that will solve it. That will save people a lot of time, effort, money, and could be the difference between building a successful company and going down a direction that won't serve you as a early builder or early entrepreneur.
Yeah, I think that's the 101 of what you stated, Daniel, because 1A, thank you for acknowledging that. And I think because of the many conversations you've had with leaders across the country, you and I in our intimate conversations, is that you see this oversaturation of specific tools at the classroom level. But I always say, how do we now create that alignment or that equilibrium of this oversaturation of classroom tools, but how do we now have leaders to be able to utilize specific tools that can be in alignment with what is being implemented at the classroom level? Improving business intelligence. I think that, Daniel, you know, when you stated that, that has to be a rooted principle within any learning organization or within any executive leader that is in the education ecosystem, where I don't think, Daniel, and I don't know the percentile of it or the percentage of it, but I don't think enough business intelligence with regards to a variety of different data sets and really creating those specific implications via through their BI application within their districts is not happening enough. And then, Daniel, also too, you know, I always say that there's these structural gaps. You know, one, and we can allude on this question, is that A, because of how our technological and information infrastructures are built, and there's immense silos between, whether it be dashboards or even sometimes in management systems, do we even have the internal systems to have high level, high quality AI that goes on in the schools as well? So I think that for early entrepreneurs and early ed tech founders, this is please go back to this question or to Daniel's answer, because I think that now, if you're really trying to look for and solve administrative problems and issues, I think that's where now we can start alleviating that oversaturation that Daniel's talking about. And then also too, understanding what the core problem is and the needs, as Daniel highlighted before, at that pre-build stage, where that now leads to the EdTech founder with time, efficiency, and money with that. But Daniel, on to the next question as well. I want to ask you to unpack this question from an asset mindset lens, right? We see a lot in education, a deficit mindset lens, as it's underscored, but I want you to focus your response on from this asset mindset lens. But for EdTech companies, early EdTech companies, early founders, how do you see technology, kind of going back to your response for the second question, how do you see technology solving operational and structural challenges that we see in education, right? Let me just give you an example. An operational and structural challenge or quandary that I used to face is I wanted to create that integrated, synergistic infrastructure architecture where now I'm looking at diverse data sets so I can have that business intelligence perspective so that now I can be able to pilot or experiment with specific continuous improvement cycles, this iterative basis. That, Daniel, that does not exist because of how the operating model is designed in education. But how can it solve immediate and long-term issues so that learning organizations and executives and superintendents are aligned to the rapid economic shifts and demands we're encountering now in our everyday lives?
There are, I think schools, school systems, educational entities tend to be slow adopters of technology. And, you know, you think about, there was a time where school, not every school, you know, an SIS, right? And now every school must have an SIS. And, you know, I think the data warehouse is the sort of, I think a lot of people are talking about AI right now, like it's AI everything. And I don't think enough attention is, you know, there's the fundamentals, the boring stuff that makes AI truly impactful and effective. And so I think if you're a educational leader, you're a site-based leader, you're a district leader, if you, you know, if you're thinking about leveraging, you know, new AI systems, I think the first question you need to ask yourself is, do I have a data warehouse? Because that's the foundation of even beyond AI, just having interoperability in your own software ecosystem. You know, there's a lot of attention at schools, you know, around, and I think this is totally right. I mean, I am amazed and I am so impressed with every single educator, principal, IT administrator during COVID, the rapid digital transformation. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's patriotic to me, it's one of the things that brought me, you know, because I was working in big tech at the time. I had to leave education to work in the highest echelons of software engineering. But what brought me back to education was the pandemic. It was that push to move everything online overnight. And I think a lot of school, you know, money was made available so schools could do this as effectively as possible. And, you know, schools were adopting anything and everything they could. And now we've done a lot of work with schools in trying to go, okay, what are you paying? You know, it's kind of like when your Netflix subscriptions and your streaming services kind of, you've got too many of them to even watch, and you go backwards and say, okay, you prune your own personal subscriptions. I think if schools aren't doing that, they should be, and they are, right? Going, okay, are we really, you know, they're assessing whether or not they're really using them. They're looking at the efficacy, and we've done a lot of work there. But the next step of that is the interoperability between those tools. You know, there's definitely some vendor and provider accountability. The software providers need to make their tools more interoperable. But I also think, and we don't talk about this, and I say it as well with respect, that, you know, school systems have a bit more responsibility for making their data more actionable as well. So I think I think that it's very inexcusable on the vendor side to have limited interoperability. But I think that as we get further into this digital age that we're in, it's no longer a one-sided vendors must make this interoperable. I think school leaders, especially on the IT side, you know, are becoming part of the, and the tool, you know, AI tools are making this more possible for people who are highly technical. Maybe they didn't learn code, you know, I'm thinking about like the network administrator who, and there's no, you know, 5 years ago, a network administrator, you know, writing and connecting software systems wasn't always a guarantee. But I think now as systems become more interoperable and these folks have access to more knowledge and even, you know, agentic flows through code. I think, you know, developing that internal software ecosystem, it should revolve around a data warehouse. And so for schools that, you know, have more than a few thousand students, and even for schools that don't, you know, if you don't have a data warehouse, I think it's imperative, because I think there's going to be a rush. Like once truly agentic AGI becomes more available, more developed, you don't want to be caught without the infrastructure you need to support that future.
Well stated. To my audience, Daniel, we use this Voices for Excellence as a professional learning tool, asynchronous, that's focused on heterogogy, self-directed learning, right? Obviously, the adult learning sciences of that. And to my audience, this is an answer that I want you to play back, because Daniel stated this word 8 times. And to me, it is an educational imperative in education as we are in this AC 2035 state. And Daniel, of course, you know about the AC stage of education, now moving to AC 2035. The word to my audience that Daniel stated is interoperability. And Daniel, I didn't learn about the processes of interoperability or what the definition of interoperability was until I went to my business analytics program and went through that trajectory. And this was in the BC stage of education. This was before COVID. And I think that now we're starting to adopt specific vocabulary in the education ecosystem, where now interoperability is a necessity in order to advance and accelerate learning organizational goals and objectives. To my viewers and to my audience, Daniel stated this, and it's vital if we truly want to make data actionable, right? Daniel is absolutely correct that data was not as actionable in the BC stage of education, even at the outset of the AC stage of education, because our systems did not have the necessary functionality for interoperability. Now we have these processes that can be implemented within our learning organizations so that now that data is connected. But Daniel, for level setting purposes for my audience, could you define what interoperability looks like within a data warehouse so that they can be able to have a simplified conceptual visualization of what that looks like?
Yeah. And I think I want to answer the question, and I also want to expand a little bit about what a data warehouse is and why, because I think the sort of traditional wisdom might be, let's get a lot of information into our student information system. And while that is definitely one path forward, having space for your data to live, that can be defined in a shape or schema of data that perfectly suits analytical and also your bespoke purpose, meaning when you are using an SIS, that SIS is primarily from a data perspective designed to support the functionality and workflows that you use your SIS for. And while reporting is an important feature, reporting is different than data storage, analytics, and warehousing. They are neighbors, they are cousins, but they are different.
And I'm glad you're defining this, Daniel, because
yeah,
101 that you're unpacking, there is a lot of unfamiliarity with this, because again, executive leaders, superintendents, CEOs, CAOs, they do not really get to the depth and breadth of what you're describing. Now, truly talking about interoperability, the residual is the chief academic officer is going to have to work with the CIO or the CTO. When we look at, you know, data that's coming from the SIS, how can we use data from the SIS and academic data, concatenate those data sets for business intelligence. So this is the point that you don't understand.
And having the right place to store that, right? Like technically, you could create custom tables in your PowerSchool instance and put HRS data in there, but it's not the perfect storage solution. It's the same way that I could technically put my silverware, you know, in the cupboard over, you know, not the actual dedicated silverware. So you need dedicated space to store your data. It also means that you have less dependencies on these systems, meaning if you were to invest so heavily in your student information system, which isn't necessarily the worst place to put your investment, if you ever wanted to change, make an adjustment, you risk that all that work that's gone into that customization, where if you have a dedicated space, you know, we're at a point now where having a dedicated space for your data that is agnostic of the systems you use, that became a nice to have. It was a nice to have, and it's becoming more and more of a necessity. And so that's becoming very, very critical, and it enables you to do so much more with your data, and you're not limited to the bounds of the systems that you work with every day. And then it's not tied to, like, you know, your operational systems, their primary purpose should be operations, and your analytics system, its primary purpose should be analytics, data retention and storage. I think, you know, in the next 5 years or decade, I think it would feel really silly if a front office didn't have a copier. I think that it will be just as silly to not have a data warehouse. I think, and for the schools that I work with where we've implemented data warehouses, it is at that level of, if a front office didn't have a copier, they would be in trouble. And I think in the same vein for schools that have, you know, implemented those tools, they're finding that same level. It's remarkable. And from a cost savings perspective, I mean, some of the work I'm very proud of that I did some years ago, working with a school system that had two data analysts that a good chunk of their work was exporting data from different systems, getting them into spreadsheets, running fragile macros, and getting data to the leadership team. We implemented a data warehouse and an ETL pipeline, which was enabled by interoperability of those systems. That interoperability meaning the ability to grab data outside of a system's workflow, so like from an API or a data export. So we automated a lot of that work together and upskilled those analysts so they were able to support that automation instead of the manual work they were doing. The long story short is that the process not only got more real time and more accurate, but then it freed up 80 hours of technical time from these folks every week, and that enabled them to build a suite of over 100. They got to work directly with their district leaders to then say, what do you want to know right now? And then start developing exactly that, like region specific, school system specific reporting, because they weren't spending their time doing what the data warehouse could do. And when you have that data warehouse, the data is stored in a way where you don't have to check it every time, because it's automatic, you know, it is in a stable stored state. And so now this team was able to focus their time on moving the needle, not maintaining the status quo, but moving that needle forward. And it was very productive for that team. It's very cost saving for that team, and it improved their operational excellence.
Absolutely. Daniel, where were you when I was a leader? Because A, you're eliminating fragmentation. B, you're creating what I like to say, shared operational efficiencies and efficacy. You're defining what efficacy looked like from that context. And then the data becomes real time, that's automated. Wow. Just imagine if leaders have that time that can be repurposed where now it can accelerate academic outcomes, it can accelerate teacher capacity, and then also to having that real-time dynamic of being iterative within the prototype of the model. Daniel, wow, that is just absolutely phenomenal. I just can't wait, Daniel, wait until we actually have this level of real-time data that can be operationalized in an IoT form. We're now interoperability, bringing multiple data sets, and then some of these really complex, dense questions that we're trying to solve for would be much easier for the leaders as well. But Daniel, I want to jump into when learning organizations, when they want to start modernizing, because we talked about the fragmentation, you know, of data, architecture within our schools and everything. But I want to talk about the digital footprint, right? And right now, I think that there's this level of systems tension that inhibits interoperability of what we were talking about. So if we know that we have these inherent systems or structural tensions that prevent interoperability from entering the educational landscape, kind of like this level set universal dynamic. If I was a leader, Daniel, what are the non-negotiables for me from an architectural foundation standpoint? What is actually required to make it scalable? But moreover, how can I now look at these tensions and address them so that my learning organization become ready for this digital ecosystem that we're talking about around transformation?
What is non-negotiable? I mean, I can speak to, like, as an engineer, I'm going to get all technical about what, I mean, I think there's always the level of what are non-negotiables. I think these are 99% of the time non-negotiables. Sometimes I've seen folks adopt tools that aren't interoperable in the slightest. They are going against the grain of that footprint, that ecosystem that this school system has spent time pruning and caring for. But I think there are a few things that can really just reduce friction immediately from a product. And I'm also going to put a caveat in here. I'm not going to get into cybersecurity right now. I think that needs to be a given. And I think for leaders and decision makers, that's well understood.
Before you go on, shout out to Julia Fallon. Her report that came out of CETA, it was the number one focus or number one concern, I believe it was cybersecurity that kind of taken over. The number one focus was around AI. So absolutely, Dan, I'm glad you brought cybersecurity up.
Yeah, and I bring it up just to say it is a number one concern. So no need to we would want to just have a whole other podcast to talk about the musts of cybersecurity. So we're just caveat there. I mean, I think there's three things that are really critical to reducing friction. I think one is having a very thoughtful onboarding process. And having that rostering piece, if you don't have that, you know, seamless rostering experience, you better be white gloving. And you know this, Dr. Connor, in our work, where, you know, when we work with a school system that doesn't have that, you know, doesn't have a system like PowerSchool, that we white glove their onboarding, because we're not going to put another task on that back office team that already has way too much going on. So I think a great way to reduce friction is through having a great, so as a leader assessing, like, what is this, you know, what is the rostering process? Just as importantly, and maybe even more so, I would say, is having a strong SSO, single sign-on option. For a lot of people, that's Clever. For some people, that's Google. But having that piece so that, especially if it's a student-facing learning tool, you know, that's a must-have. And then the final piece, I think, for reducing, and these are the things that, you know, when I was a decision maker, you know, because my background was in schools as well. So schools, big tech, back to schools, started School Harbor. But when I was making these decisions, the three things I looked at was SSO, the rostering experience, obviously the cybersecurity. But then what is my, because I didn't even look, you know, I think a lot of folks will look at the platform and look for feature, like what are the reports that your platform had? Like I never cared what reports your platform had. I cared, can I get 100% of my data out of your platform into my data warehouse? Right. So I think like, so having that ability to easily connect data from that platform into that central, you know, data repository, that data warehouse, I think those are the three critical things for reducing friction, for creating cohesive ecosystem. Is can how easy is it for data to go in? How easy is it for data to go out? And how easy is it to sign in?
Absolutely. And you know what? When I listen to you unpack this, Daniel, you just make it so sound so simple. And how come universally we can't adopt this, you know, simultaneously? But I agree 100% that SSO, right? And when we talk about SSO and cybersecurity, it's kind of your non-negotiables. We have a tendency, Daniel, that we just want to jump in as opposed to really looking at the foundations to create those conditions to really go into your data warehouse. Do we have the SSO and the processes that are embedded in it so that 100%, you know, we're not focusing on the reports, but we want to make sure 100% of the data can be transferable into the data warehouse as well. That kind of goes back to now that business intelligence around the analytics, which is so critical with that. And then the rostering experience, Daniel, even though it, you know, in when I'm putting my hat, my old executive leader hat on, you know, when I hear rostering experience, I'm like, oh, you know, that's just a simple rostering, you know, within the actual, you know, infrastructure itself or the architecture itself. But Daniel, can you just elaborate on, and you taught me this, why is it so important, or why that rostering process is such a rooted foundation to have the success of what you were talking about within your last answer?
So let's actually talk about like the consequences of suboptimal rostering. And let's do it from the lens of from a learning tool. Maybe it's a testing software or test prep. And, you know, if your students are, you know, moving between classrooms, are enrolling, unenrolling, if just one, I mean, think about, I mean, if you've never gone, especially to like first or second grade classroom, you know, if you've never tried to, if you've never seen 37-year-olds get onto computers, go do that. Okay. And so when you just doing that in a perfect world where you have S, you do not have an individual user password for a set. Oh my goodness. That seems so simple, but you'd be surprised. And even if you've got like the QR code, and by the way, the QR code, like login for, you know, the clever badge, that support that. But so you're in this, you've rolled out a Chromebook cart and you've got to pass all these out and you got a lot of these students in. And if your roster is not right, because it's already challenging and chaotic. And the educator's now thinking, oh, this isn't working because this student's account doesn't exist because the rostering failed, or the rostering is updated by hand, you know, and you don't want your user story to be, oh, well, that teacher can just go log into my platform and then add that student to their classroom. No, they're what? Like that's. Yeah, it's like going to a restaurant and then the chef saying, make your own burger. You know, they can just make their own. If I don't have a patty, they can just make their own. And that's good, right? I mean, you really do need to reduce that friction as much as possible. And you can do that through regularly updated, right? And it doesn't need to be to the second roster. I mean, even just a daily refresh is more than, you know, more than sufficient.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Daniel, this is, it's, I'm glad that you brought this up, right? And I think that, you know, sometimes, you know, district leaders, they'll tell their stakeholders, they'll tell their leaders, hey, make your own burger. You know, there's not enough patties.
Yeah.
You
know, That's the solution. Just make your own. Yeah. Look, we made 99 out of 100 of the orders. You know what I mean? But then you're leaving a real human student behind. Nothing displays this more. The number one, I help a school system with their dismissal software every year. And I personally handle this personally as just because it's something that gives me so much heartburn, because you do the first day of school is already the first day of school, and like you cannot be wrong on the dismissal process, because nothing is going to make a parent more concerned or nervous than, oh, I don't, your kid wasn't called, that they're in the wrong, we don't know which classroom they're in, you know what I mean, like that kind of thing. And that's just one. I mean, you can be 99.5% accurate, and that one student that has the dismissal issue, you know, you just don't want to be, as somebody who provides software and provides those solutions, you know, there's just not room for that kind of error. It's yeah.
No, Daniel, this is great. This is great. And to my audience, again, continue to unpack Daniel's answers and his responses. And I intentionally design and develop these questions because, and I hear us automatically jumping into this AI conversation, this adoption AI, you know, mindset. But when we think about this from an arrival AI lens, just like how electricity has disrupted our natural environment and lives, and AI from this arrival perspective, we have to unpack it and get down to the foundations. And in order for us to have or to leverage successful AI, exactly what Daniel is presenting, exactly what Daniel is unpacking with his responses, this is the prerequisite or the pretext, and for us to be able to have successful AI and this AI-centric culture within our learning organizations. And now, Daniel, I'm going to ask the AI question, because we built the foundation, the cognitive foundation, to now start thinking about this AI-centric culture other than or in lieu of a culture of using AI tools. How must we approach this? In essence, what you were describing is change management. How much of this approach do we have to underpin change management for operational efficiencies that are human-centric?
I think when it comes to approaching AI, staying human-centric, I use the term AI sobriety, which is both understanding that there's this emerging tool and technology, and it is both powerful and limited, and it is changing and improving. And so I think that keeping, you know, there's a lot of folks who are rightfully excited about developments in AI, but as somebody who develops tools that, you know, integrating AI, when is the appropriate time to use it? What is AI in its current state good at? How are we anticipating how it will improve? You know, there were things that we thought would be like streaming movies was something that was inconceivable during dial-up.
Right.
Inconceivable. Right. Not even you'd be laughed off the stage if you said that people are going to get rid of DVDs, right? That's just... And understand, you know, and I think what's brilliant is you look at a company like Netflix that started off as, Netflix is a great example of like maybe the antithesis of what people think about when they think about tech. I mean, was Netflix really that much of a tech company when they were mailing DVDs? Were they? I mean, I think like operationally, yes, they were an internet company. They were, you know, but think about how as the internet changed, and it's not just a software, you know, it's not just an AI, it's a, you know, data centers, infrastructure, our supply, you know, this is a global and multifaceted problem, or not problem, but development. And so like all of these, just trying to understand it, like it, which was fascinating with Netflix, is it's like they went from sending DVDs to completely and fundamentally transforming the entire movie industry. And that's the same company. And I think, so like what we're doing with AI, we're at the DVD phase. We're at the dial-up phase. And so there's a lot of, so you don't want to make choices necessarily or critical Like, I think a lot of people are making, we're seeing it now, people have been making, you know, staffing choices based on thinking that AI will be in a certain place and then going back and, you know, a lot of AI pilots are failing. And that's okay. That's part of it. You know, so we have to stay, we just, if we stay grounded and we know that that's the case, we know that most of these, you know, I love what we did, Dr. Connor. I think staying, we've been very AI sober in our work, which in our first year of doing our work, we level set with leaders and said, hey, this is the experimental group. Like, we didn't overprompt. We said, here's what we were trying to accomplish together as a team. We weren't, here's your software, drop it off on their doorstep and walk away. It was leader. And I think, like, as a vendor, us doing this, being that partner and saying, we're developing this AI platform for then you to give us this feedback, for you to use and teach, for us to learn with you. I think staying grounded can create a lot of value. Like, we don't have to be in the Star Wars universe to do something futuristic. You can, that's human, it is human centric to say we are going to both use AI, but also create a human-based community of excellent leaders to explore it. And so I think keeping your implementation, like, rooted in the reality of what the tool can do now, and not trying to over predict where it will be, but rolling with the availability. Netflix did that. They did the DVDs, and as the technology changed, they adapted to it and built their business that way. And, you know, before they knew it, they're, you know, the biggest name out there. And so I think, like, as leaders of site-based leaders, district-based leaders, you know, ed tech providers, we're all doing the same. We all have the same mission, which is to improve operational efficiency so that, and to improve learning outcomes so we can have better schools and better outcomes for learners. We're all on this same team. And so I think, like, operating from a grounded, you know, community-based approach for adopting technology and not jumping the gun on, you know, I think a lot of people gravitate to wanting to be the most futuristic. And I actually think that that's kind of the antithesis of being truly futuristic, which is taking a step back, working with the people around you, and staying, like, rooted in the reality of our moment, which is that AI isn't capable of doing most things well enough to put in front of students, and that AI is very good at helping us put things in front of students more effectively with the same level of fidelity or more faster, but in a human-centric approach, not a completely, we're not there yet. We might be, but we're not there yet. And so I think understanding that and then taking that approach.
I love that, Daniel. Specifically, what you stated at the outset, AI sobriety, right? And we absolutely did that approach. I thought it was very intentional via the experimental group, you know, with the Agile platform. But what I loved the example that you provided with Netflix, because as you were talking about Netflix, right, and basically how they shifted their operating model, it went back. I go back to one of my professors that I had. Shout out to Professor Michael Tushman. He wrote the book Lead and Disrupt, and he talks about exploitation and exploration. It's kind of like, it was his theory that we have to be able to exploit specific elements and dimensions within our business model, and we have to continuously explore for what that next level of innovation, but with a level of sobriety, right? Never going to use the example with that within that process. And again, Daniel, one thing I will always remember, right? And this was when we started our journey with the Agile platform. You said always look at this from an MVP state, and we're going to be in this continuous MVP state, you know, with regards to our platform, really emulates the process that Netflix took from its evolution to now. with that. But again, Daniel, you have some of the best analogies across this country, and I'm going to nominate you to be the educator analogy of the year for that. But Daniel, last question, and I don't know if I can do this because I've known you for 3 years, know you very well. And to limit you to three words is going to be very, very hard. And I think there's only probably, you know, one other person in your life that can limit you to three words. And yes, it is my great friend, Daniel's wife, Letty. But Daniel, what three words do you want today's audience to leave our podcast with regarding edtech companies and school leaders collaborating intentionally, keyword intentionally, to build school and data infrastructures so that learning organizations are AC 2035 ready?
I mean, these are like, so I'm going to say three words, just like word, word, word.
To my audience, yes, that's a technical Daniel's mind is, yeah, three words, Daniel.
Okay. Well, we said it eight times or more now. So let's definitely say interoperability. Let's use the word. Can I use like a foundational infrastructure / data warehouse? Am I pushing the limit? You know, data warehouse. Maybe I'll just say that.
Okay, data warehouse. Yep.
And don't forget to listen to John Cage's 4 minutes and 33 seconds. So I'll say John Cage.
John Cage. And I'm going to check that out, Daniel, because that is absolutely phenomenal. And I'm going to I might even have this as one of my exercises within my microcredential program or my doctoral class. But interoperability, data warehouse, and John Cage, 4 minutes and 33 seconds. Mr. Daniel Crook, thank you for coming on VFE. You lasted, my good brother. Now, Daniel, if anybody wants to get in touch with you, want to learn more about School Harbor, the work that's being underpinned at School Harbor, if I'm an early tech founder or CEO that's starting a startup, how would I be able to get in contact with you?
Yeah, just find us, just put School Harbor into Google. You know, I'm on LinkedIn, so I'm always happy to take a call anytime, you know. So if there's anything I can ever be helpful with, always happy to have a conversation. So yeah, find us at schoolharbor.com. Reach out to me on LinkedIn.
Absolutely. Thank you, Daniel. And again, a lot of my audience, they do reach out. So expect some emails, expect some calls or inquiries to School Harbor. But again, Daniel, A, I want to thank you for coming on VFE, but also B, for being such a strategic partner, for being such a good co-founder, partner to me as we continue to try to change the landscape of education. And again, to my audience, please reach out to Daniel. Please reach out to School Harbor. School Harbor is, like I said, and I'm saying this objectively and subjectively, one of the best in the country. So Daniel Crook, you made it through, my friend. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you. And right back at you when it comes to the partnership.
Absolutely. And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.